there's a discussion on blood, it's okay. So I think we should get the blood, because there's even no idea. I think I put a second on it. Is it two of us? Okay, hematologic disorders. Talking about blood, right? Just make sure we're recording. I'm getting the pinwheels in there. What's happening? Good, we look like. So, blood. I talked a little bit about it with you last semester. We talked a little bit about what blood did. So, tell me what you know about blood. Why is it so important? What does it do? What's the main function of blood? Anybody have any idea? Carries oxygen, yeah. Specifically, what part of blood carries oxygen? Hemoglobin, which are what? What's hemoglobin? It's another name for hemoglobin. What is hemoglobin? No. You need iron as a building block. Hemoglobin is a red blood cell that has oxygen molecules attached. And if you remember, I believe each oxygen molecule can hold three of them, right? Four. I believe each oxygen molecule can hold four, and each blood cell can hold four molecules of oxygen. So hemoglobin, you look at a hemoglobin count, right, when you're doing lab work? And what is that telling you? Compared to the hematocrit, so. Know the difference? Hemoglobin is the oxygen carrying capacity. Makes sense, because hemoglobin is a red blood cell filled with oxygen. Versus hematocrit, where it's just a percent of red blood cells. So know that difference. As you have discovered, generally they're in line, right? They both go up together, or they go down together. We're going to talk about some times today where possibly they won't be. Where you'll have plenty of red blood cells, but an inability to carry oxygen. Okay. So yeah, you're right, the blood carries oxygen in the form of hemoglobin, which are red blood cells with oxygen molecules attached. Now where does that attachment take place? In the where?
The lungs.
Yeah, the lungs, right? Exactly, in the alveoli. That's where the blood comes in contact with oxygen. And where is it then released to the cells?
Capillary
beds. Then the non-oxygenated red blood cells go back to the lungs. And at this point, they have carbon dioxide on them, right? And they drop off the carbon dioxide and pick up the O2. And it goes around again. So the blood is like a freeway, right? Or a river, carrying these cells. And we were specifically talking about red blood cells and the importance of oxygen transport. That's not all the blood transports, is it? What else?
Nutrients.
Yeah. And? What else? There are the cells in the blood hanging out, right? What are they? Right blood cell. What else? We're going to talk a little bit about bleeding disorders. That's a big thing.
Platelets.
Good. So blood is extremely important as far as transporting everything the body needs around it. Now there's another circulatory system besides the blood circulatory system, right? The lymphatic system. very important when we talked about inflammation and infection. It carries white blood cells. So if you have hypervolemia, too much blood, too much volume of blood, that may be because you've got your IV drip's been dripping too much for too long. Or you're ingesting a tremendous amount of fluid. What are the labs going to look like? They're going to be low because they're what? Diluted. So someone actually can have water poisoning, can't they? Because if you have so much volume of blood that your percentages are down so low that you can't maintain function. So you can't drink too much water, you have too much volume. Conversely, we all know about dehydration, right? And what are the lab values going to look like there? They're going to be consistently high. So if you're looking at your labs and they're all high, and the person has a living diagnosis of dehydration, it's a good guess is that they're, and you look at the labs maybe from admission, that yeah, these lab values don't have anything to do with all these other problems that you're thinking of, you know, like a liver or a renal issue. It's probably simply dehydration. But I could just take your lab work just a step farther. You're doing well about your thinking, but you put down things like anemia, which is great, or hypervolemia, great. Now think a little further. Why? Why are they anemic? Why are you seeing hypervolemia? Take it, just start expanding your thinking a little bit for the second part of the semester. And kind of get your head around blood and what that it is, like a river, just transporting all these things. And we're very much in charge of the volume in a body. And that's going to be directly expressed in those lab values. So blood's extremely important. Other reasons why we may, how are we going to lose blood? We're going to not make enough, right? Maybe if we're dehydrated, we don't have enough volume, we don't have enough. We may have some physiological problem that inhibits the making of cells. Right? What other ways might we be deficient in amounts of blood? Excellent. Surgery. Or what else? Trauma. Excellent. Anything else we've talked about? In two of our lectures, we talked about some other issues that might cause the vascular system to be deficient.
Like a GI bleed?
Exactly. A GI bleed. Or a bleed anywhere. Let's say it was, we talked about aneurysms too, and aneurysms sometimes don't rupture, they just kind of ooze. Got it? This is a kind of general catch-up, so we're all on the same page. So hematologic disorders, we're talking about problems with the blood. One of our main problems, of course, is anemia. I'm sure you have all put down, at least at this point, on a lab route of anemia. You've dealt with a patient with anemia.
Sure.
Most everybody has. And anemia can be caused by decreased production of red blood cells, increased loss, as we said, through trauma, through surgery, through some kind of bleed, increased destruction. Okay. There'll be some pathological conditions that tend to destroy red blood cells. And obviously acute blood loss, anemia. So when you say your trauma victim is anemic, I want you to not just put anemic next to the red blood cells, say related to blood loss from trauma or from surgery or bleed. Okay? So take it a step further. Or if it's a pathology, say related to whatever that is. So these signs and symptoms make all sorts of sense for anemia. Has anyone been diagnosed with anemia here that would like to share about it? Great, tell us about it.
Well, when I first started my period, I was anemic for a while.
Oh, when you were that young?
Mm-hmm. And Yeah, I'm still kind of, it runs in my family, but I'm mostly, as of now, I'm iron deficient anemia, and I have it pretty well managed with, I eat a lot of collard greens and spinach, and I can really manage it, but I get cold really easily, and I turn blue a lot.
And it's hard to get blood, right?
Yeah.
You always get turned away. Extremely common. I think I read somewhere like 20% of young women are anemic at some point in their lives. Very, very common. Yeah, there's some idea of the blood loss during menses, but that's fairly minimal. Normally it's more hereditary, kind of where your body functions. My guess is you'll probably always have to be careful because you just don't have kind of a borderline deal. Do you remember how you felt? You were pretty young. I mean, it's been a while. Do you remember how you felt?
Well,
or have you had episodes of exacerbation since then?
I was really tired, yeah. And I couldn't. It felt like I couldn't get enough sleep. And then I lost a lot of weight. And then my grandma actually thought I was diabetic because my mom.
Good guess.
Was,
yeah.
So that I went in to get tested for that, and they said that I was just anemic.
And so you were really tired. That's obvious, right? Why would someone be tired? Not enough oxygen in her cells, right? So she's going to be tired. And I guess you're pretty pale.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. I can usually look around and spot anemic people in the room. I don't see any today. Your guys are all pretty healthy, unless you're fooling me. But yeah, it really shows. You can see it very easily in the face most of the time, because our faces are pretty thin. So yeah, you're pale. Also, why would heart and respiratory rates rise? Why does that make sense? You probably didn't get to that point, but certainly it's hypoxia, right? Last week we learned about early and late hypoxia. That's exactly what you're experiencing with anemia, because all hypoxia is lack of oxygen, right, to the brain. So anemia could certainly present itself as hypoxia, which relates. So why are we going to see heart and respiratory rates rise? Why is that going to be a compensatory mechanism? Exactly, we're compensating. What are we trying to do? More oxygen around, so there's not that many red blood cells, which is what anemia is, a decrease in red blood cells. We can even, with anemics, we can even put a whole bunch of water in them or whatever, and you're still going to have a deficiency in red blood cells. So you may correct the volume, but you're not going to be able to correct the numbers of red blood cells. They either have to build more red blood cells. We give iron to facilitate that. We give epipoietin to facilitate that. We give transfusions, okay, to get more red blood cells in the body. But nonetheless, the heart, if we can't do that real fast, we may be fine for volume, but we still don't have enough of the red blood cells carrying that oxygen, so the respiratory rate is going to go up. Because the lungs want to be sure that whatever red blood cells are there are completely saturated with oxygen before they go out to the body. We're going to take advantage of every single possible, every hemoglobin site is going to be filled. Every red blood cell is going to have its full hemoglobin to be saturated before it goes out. And then heart, yeah, let's just pump faster. Let's get all this stuff around as fast as we can. Okay? But when we don't have enough, tissue hypoxia, fatigue, angina even, we talked about the heart. Headache, dizziness, division as you move into a later stage of hypoxia, right? And confusion. Okay. You talked a little bit about nutritional, the collard greens, right? And that works for you now, right? Yeah. Yes.
So could anemia cause like chronic migraine headaches?
Migraine headaches are generally a vascular problem where there's an expansion, contraction. Could it cause it? I've never heard that it causes it.
I'm curious, since my sister has a little stress, like really bad migraines, and we can't seem to figure out like what the cause is. So
migraines, we're going to talk a little bit about migraines later in the semester. Most of the time people don't know the cause. And there have been theories. It generally is, the onset is you know, with menses, it's right around, she's probably, she's a teenager.
Yeah, she's 14.
Yeah, that's a real common time of onset. People have thought about bariatric pressure. Simply, if there's more pressure, people are sensitive, and it causes expansion of the vessels and everything. Chocolate, I mean, I've heard everything.
She thinks it's cheese right now. But
you know, she may have some allergy. she very well may have a lactose allergy that prompts it. And I think that it's just some people vessel dilate, they cause that kind of pain, they go into migraines and it's horrible. I'm hoping that meds help her.
Yeah, kind of. We're working on it. She gets them like once a month now. It used to be a lot more than that, but.
Well, you'll have to bring her up when we talk about headaches. I don't know. I have not ever read a direct correlation. But she may very well be anemic, too, because this is a time when so often young women find that they're anemic. Mm-hmm. And it certainly wouldn't be helping if she's anemic. So make sure her diet's good, and maybe an iron-rich multivitamin would not be a bad thing. Okay, for all of us. All right, so nutritional deficiencies, sure. Inadequate diet. Somebody was talking this morning about how she just wasn't eating much. Real busy nursing student, didn't have a real good diet, and was diagnosed with anemia. Okay, not really anything missing, just not enough food. Simple. Malabsorption of nutrients. Yeah, some people have trouble absorbing, and an increased need, like an increased need for iron or whatever that many iron deficient anemics have. In general, to build red blood cells, what do we need to ingest? Iron, of course, right? And where do we get that? You say collard greens, spinach. What else?
Protein.
Nice, good red meat is excellent. You see it commonly. Your sister's not being a vegetarian, is she?
No, she's not.
Okay. Because you see it commonly in young people who haven't done all the research to get a real balanced diet.
Yeah, she doesn't eat great. I don't. Yeah. She can work on it.
Maybe just good vitamin.
What?
Maybe a good vitamin.
Yeah.
Maybe. Make you feel better. You know, honestly, the children's chewables are really good.
Yeah.
Have your pop a couple of children's chewables if she's like, that would be good for her. Mm-hmm. So there's iron deficient anemia, like we've discussed. Brittle spoon-shaped nails is common. Kylosis, which is kind of a fissuring of the skin around the lips. It gets dry and kind of has some fissures. A smooth, sore tongue, and pica. I think we talked about pica once before. Do you remember what it is? Maybe not in this class. Do you remember? Eating of odd things. It's not uncommon during pregnancy. It's also seen in iron deficient anemia. Most commonly in women, people eat freezer ice, paint off walls, glue, paste, that kind of thing. Okay. Yeah, it's a craving for an abnormal kind of thing, Freezer ice apparently is very common among pregnant people. Also, iron deficient anemia. B12 deficient anemia, which is why a nice multivitamin for your sister might be good. You'll see you're giving a lot of iron to patients. Have you been giving iron to patients? Have you noticed it yet? No? We do, commonly. Sometimes we even give iron IV. Yeah, bags of iron. It's very interesting. But be really careful because it is it's a thing that's called a vesicon? Where it can injure the skin if it gets into it. So you have to make sure that it goes directly into the vein, because if there's an infiltration with iron, it can be very dangerous to the skin. Visicant, I think is what it is. So we even give iron IV. You'll certainly be giving B to your patients. Often we give B, and often we give folic acid for folic acid anemia. Very similar kinds of symptoms, no matter what anemia you're talking about. Diarrhea is an interesting a symptom of folic acid anemia that I haven't seen in other anemias. But in general, anemia is not, it's a primary diagnosis. We don't know why it's done with anemia. In the hospital, we're seeing a lot of secondary anemics, blood loss, surgery, all this stuff. That would make sense. But in a common population, people are diagnosed with anemia, we're not real sure why. So we give them iron, and that usually fixes it, and we assume it's iron deficient. Pregnant women routinely get anemia. We're assuming that's iron deficient anemia. Because they're just simply making so much more blood for this whole body they're carrying. They can't keep up. So we do iron replacement, vitamin B12, folic acid. We're doing all this. But what about sickle cell? Completely different kind of anemia, isn't it? Is anybody familiar with sickle cell? Have any experience with that? Know anybody with sickle cell? Yeah.
I had a patient who had sickle cell anemia. And
tell us about your patient.
She was 22. She was really young and she was pregnant and she was having, it was, I think, her third pregnancy. She had a couple miscarriages before. It was really hard for her to keep it, and she was at 5 weeks and she just kept counting and she was really determined to keep this one. So it was really sad, but also really touching.
So why was she in the hospital?
She had a, like an attack kind of?
A crisis?
Yes, a crisis.
Sickle cell crisis, we'll talk about that. Yeah, did you learn about the physiology behind your crisis?
Not the crisis itself, but from my understanding, the sickle cell unit, it was just like an oddly, like an odd shape, so that they're not able to flow properly.
That is a pathophys, yeah. So the red blood cells are sickled in shape, so they look like half moon, right? So they can't, the oxygen molecules don't grab onto them, they can't carry oxygen. And obviously, if we had 100% sickled cells, we couldn't live because there'd be no oxygen transport. So people have a mixture. And some people are far worse than others, right? Depending on how healthy you are, if you've lost some blood, whatever, your percentage of sickled cells is going to differ. So she had a crisis. And so what was that? Do you know? Do you know what precipitated? Okay, you're absolutely right about the sickle cells clumping. Okay? Yeah, the sickle cells have two problems. They can't carry oxygen, and they get clumped in the vessels. So when they clump up in the vessels, they retard the blood flow, right? Thereby, the oxygen going to many of the tissues that are distal to the clump. Generally, there's some blood getting through, but it's not flowing regularly. So if tissue isn't getting oxygen, what's going to happen? Yeah, but before that, we don't let it get that far. Eventually it'll die, but we're not going to go there. Let's go backwards, back up. What happens first?
Cells.
Pardon me?
Cells.
Cells. What happens to cells if they're not getting enough oxygen?
They don't die.
Well, they don't die yet. They first, what do they first do? Do we have a hand
there?
What do they do? They all get in. Normally, cells have aerobic respiration, right? So what happens when they don't have enough oxygen?
They don't like
the gas. Anaerobic respiration, which means metabolism without enough oxygen. And the byproduct of this is lactic acid. Okay, now what happens to that muscle that has all that lactic acid in it? You got it. Cramps, and it's painful, and that's your sickle cell crisis. It's horrible cramping of the muscles because of the clumps that are retarding.
Is it too much lactic acid?
The cells produce the lactic acid.
Oh.
Okay, so as a result of not getting enough oxygen. So the lactic acid production in any amount is not normal. In any extreme, you know, it's a byproduct of the lack of oxygen. Yes, and the same thing that happens when you run and get a trolley horse. Okay, so yeah, same deal, exactly the same, because it's all muscle, and it's all the cellular response. It doesn't change. So, but it's extreme in sickle cell patients. Okay, so this lady was hospitalized, and you were treating two things, right? You were treating her pain, and I'm sure she was on O2, right?
Yeah,
and probably fluids. So what we're doing is we're flushing the fluid through. We want to get rid of that clump. We want to give her as much oxygen as she can so that every possible red blood cell molecule that can carry oxygen is carrying it. And let's see, and we want to treat the pain. So yeah, that is when we see sickle cell anemic patients hospitalized, is when they're in crisis. I worked in the Midwest and practiced in the Midwest and saw many sickle cell patients. I've only seen a couple here. It's fairly rare. At least if they're hospitalized here, I don't know if they're better controlled, they're less than the population, I don't know what the deal is. But I used to see it a lot in the Midwest, and there even, I was very privileged to see it was like a dialysis machine that filtered out the sickled cells. So this woman was given a transfusion, and then she went to have these cells filtered out, which was very, very interesting. So, yeah, and it's a genetic autosomal recessive disease, correct? So people can carry it and not exhibit it, right? affects all body systems, obviously, because we oxygenate everyone. Here's a nice list of signs and symptoms. And you can understand it would all have to do with decreased oxygen, decreased functioning of organs such as gallbladder. It's hereditary. And we talked about sickle cell crisis. Aplastic anemia is when the bone marrow fails to produce all three types of blood cells, leading to pancytopenia. Right? So it's a decrease in blood cells. We simply don't have enough of all kinds of blood cells. We get aplastic anemia. And that's a bone marrow problem. There's some medications for sickle cell. In general, we're going to give erythropoietin, which is going to stimulate red blood cell production. So we want any patient with anemia to have more red blood cells, to grow more red blood cells. Aplastic anemia, we give immunosuppressant therapy. Hypolytic anemia is very interesting. It's the premature lysis or rupture of red blood cells. So red blood cells are produced. That's not the problem. There's no problem with the bone marrow. The problem is that the grown red blood cells lyse. All right, they fall apart. They rupture. They don't have a full life. And what this causes the body to do is put a lot of immature red blood cells that don't have the oxygen carrying capacity of a mature blood cell into circulation. Therefore, your overall oxygen to the body is diminished. So that's hemolytic, which makes sense. Hemo, blood, lytic, lysis, to lyse, to split apart, to destroy. And there are acquired ones, maybe trauma to the red blood cells, autoimmune disorders can do it, some infections can do it, immune system mediated response and some drugs. So there are lots of reasons why someone may have hemolytic anemia. In this case, splenatic enlargement. That makes sense, doesn't it? Because what does the spleen do? It captures all the casts, the red blood cells that are dying, or that are done, the old red blood cells, are captured in the spleen. So that makes sense that the spleen would then become enlarged. Get some anemia, and you get some jaundice. Okay? Yeah, the spleen enlargement?
What?
The splenatic enlargement?
Sorry.
Yeah. What the spleen does, as you remember, is it's a filter. It captures the red blood cells that are done, that are old, that are finished, the casts. We call them the casts of red blood cells. Okay? So if the red blood cells are dying early, they're lysing, they're not reaching their full maturity, they're just dying and they're not working anymore, the spleen's going to pick them up. Therefore, the spleen's going to get bigger. Okay, so that's a symptom. Jaundice would be from the liver not being able to handle that massive amounts of red blood cells that are going through and destroyed, and therefore the bilirubin production would increase, and you're going to see bilirubin in the blood is going to increase, and you're going to become jaundice. Okay? That's from the liver not it being overtaxed with the number of red blood cells to deal with. So both you're going to see repercussions of both the liver and the spleen from hemolytic anemia. So hopefully you'll see some of this. Deformity, pathologic bone fractures, symptoms. So, what do we do for anemia in general? There's some meds we talked about, erythropoietin. Most commonly in the hospital, you're going to see blood transfusions. Almost always when you see a transfusion, it's due to anemia. For of some sort. Possibly a primary anemia, where someone comes in with just, you see these old ladies just come in very anemic. Probably nutritional, it's probably iron deficient, who knows, but we give them some blood. And it's amazing how helpful it is. People losing blood in surgery, a couple days later we may give them blood. Okay. People who generally, my ALS patient, we gave blood about 3 weeks before he died, hoping that it would just boost him. He just wasn't functioning. He wasn't making enough blood cells. So we tried a transfusion, didn't do much. But, just for numerous reasons, people become anemic, And normally in the hospital, what you're going to do is a blood transfusion. And many of you have seen those, right? Yeah? I know some of you have had the opportunity to see blood transfusions. It's pretty cool, isn't it? What you probably haven't seen is the results, which is even cooler. You go back the next day and then talk to that person and see how much more perky and truly the blood is a gift of life. Truly the response from oxygen. Now their cells are getting nourished. Now they're able to function. It's quite amazing. Our nursing diagnoses are going to be activity intolerance, impaired or unused membranes, all this stuff. Nice nursing diagnoses that you can start using with an anemic patient. I know you have lots of anemic patients. So we're all getting really bored with falls. And what's the other thing you guys are doing? Pain. Okay, we're getting really bored. I don't want to see any more falls or pain. Look at some of these cool stuff. Impaired oral mucous membranes, that's a good one. Okay, but you haven't used that. Okay, so stretch your mind. Activity intolerance, you may or may not have used that. Risk for decreased cardiac output, self-care deficit, all these. So start, you know, don't let's get bored with falls and pain. We'll appreciate that. Cytisthemia is usually asymptomatic, similar to primary polycythemia. This is when there's too many red blood cells. Hemocrit higher than 55%. This may be primary, meaning we don't know why. Maybe secondary to some disease state. With too many red blood cells, hypertension. That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Now, why would there be hypertension? It makes sense to me. You tell me why. Why do you think you see hypertension when there are too many red blood cells? Polycythemia. Yeah, can I say it simpler?
Yes,
please. Okay. Yes, you are absolutely correct, Gabby. With an increased amount of red blood cells, you have increased volume of blood, which is going to cause pressure against the arterial and the vascular walls, therefore increasing blood pressure, right? Got it? Yes, okay. If you have an increased number of red blood cells, right, or an increased anything in the blood, that's going to cause increased pressure against the vascular walls, isn't it? So what's going to happen to the blood pressure? That's what blood pressure is. It's the pressure against the vascular walls. So it's going to go up. So polycythemia is a perfect example of the response of the body would be hypertension. Makes all sorts of sense. Headache, yeah, because there are vascular disturbances in the head that are probably pressing on some vessels, make it dizzy, hearing, disturbances in vision because the nerves are affected, all these things. Okay, thrombosis and hemorrhage would be classic complications, right? If you have too many red blood cells, the chances of them clumping together and bleeding are great. So, here's all the things we can do. Neutropenia, low number of neutrophils. Okay. A low number of neutrophils. You get bone pain, neurological dysfunction. Rapid bone destruction can lead to hypercalcemia. So if someone's hypercalcemic, we want to see if they have neutropenia as well, which is a low number of neutrophils. So the development of granulocytes in the bone marrow is suppressed. Those baby white blood cells are not being made for some reason. Therefore, there's not enough white blood cells to get out into circulation, so the neutrophils numbers fall rapidly. Obviously, the side effect or the result of that is going to be suppressed immunity, right? If you've got less red blood cells, your immune response is going to be significantly reduced. Make sense? Mm-hmm. So we might want to isolate these people, huh? Reverse isolation might be a good idea in the hospital. You might not want them to be next to a contagious, sneezing person. We can give growth factors, hemopoietic growth factors, to encourage the bone marrow to make more cells. Antibiotics are probably a good idea because their resistance is so low at that point, we probably want to isolate them. And your diagnosis is going to be risk for infection. Of course. Big time. They don't have enough white blood cells. They're very much risk for infection. And it's a blood disorder. Mononucleosis is when the lymph is affected. Many of the lymphocytes aren't affected with mononucleosis. Again, that's going to be a circulatory problem that causes a disease state. Okay. Anybody have mono, ever had mono? How about Epstein-Barr? Mononucleosis has been found to be caused by the Epstein-Barr virus. It's not just from kissing your boyfriend, but when you're supposed to kiss too early, else we get mononucleosis. When I was a teenager. Anna, you've been kissing. No, it's Epstein-Barr virus. Okay. But those are all the, it's probably not as common now. Those are all the symptoms. Epstein-Barr. Epstein-Barr can also exist as a virus unto itself, not necessarily mononucleosis. Self-limiting, meaning it runs its course, right? You know, that's what self-limiting means. She takes about 4 to 6 weeks. Bed rest, analgesics. What about bleeding disorders? I'm going to talk just a little bit about bleeding disorders. Has anybody dealt with a patient yet that had too much coagulation, too little coagulation? Anything like that? Disseminated intravascular coagulation? It goes back and forth. Yeah.
Well, I haven't dealt with a patient yet, but then I had thrombocytopenia.
You did?
A couple summers ago, yeah.
Oh, good. Tell us about it.
My blood was just not clotting.
Yeah.
So my platelet count, instead of it being between 300 and 100, was at 1,000.
Ooh.
Or 3,000 to 1,000. And then I bite my tongue a lot by accident.
Because it was swollen?
Yeah. I had like a blood clot kind of on my tongue, on my lips. I don't know. I tend
it's
to
sores. It's sores. Huh?
Yeah. And then whenever they would give me injections or take my blood, I had to get blood tests every single week for the whole summer before I came to you.
Yeah.
And every single time they would poke me with a needle, I'd start really getting like a lot of bruises everywhere.
Yeah.
And then I got like the TPI before actually getting to the hospital.
Explain to your friends what petechiae is.
It's like red little splotches. Not splotches, but like little
dots. Dots on the face. Mm-hmm.
It was all over my body.
Was it?
Mm-hmm.
And what are they pathophysiologically? What's petechiae? Do you know what's going on?
Not exactly. Is it like when the blood vessels are really, really like, or they rupture?
They rupture.
And then?
The tiny capillaries rupture, causing a little bit of bleed, and therefore you have these tiny, tiny bruises all over. It shows little reddish spots, right?
Yeah.
And dark red all over your body, right?
Well, the spots were.
No, they got little spots. Like freckles. Like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My mom's a nurse, so then I asked her, she's like, oh, it could be sunspots, because it was summer, so then I always be out in the sun.
Yeah.
And then.
Yeah, because they look kind of like freckles. That's not a bad, differential diagnosis, actually, yeah.
And then I would come back, I stayed out of the sun for a while, and they wouldn't go away. So it was like perfect, like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And it was happening before I went to the doctor.
Wow, you had like a major episode.
Yeah.
It didn't come on slowly, it just like hit you.
Yeah, like that's I was so sick before then too. Like I had like a fever for like a good 2 days.
Oh.
But I don't know what virus I had, but yeah, they gave me IVIG. And then I was good within like a couple of days. So.
And so now, what do you do for that? Anything?
No, it's.
You're not predisposed to another problem.
It's not.
That's not. Fascinating. That's great. It's a platelet count of larger. Thrombocytopenia is a platelet count of greater than 100,000 per milliliter of blood. That's what you were saying. Can lead to abnormal bleeding. So you either have decreased production. Okay. Or an increased sequelization in the spleen, or accelerated destruction, which means the spleen's taking in too many cells. Okay. Bleeding, and we also can do it by heparin use, right? Because if we do have too many anticoagulants, we're going to get the same thing. The blood's not going to clot, and therefore you're going to see all the manifestations that we just described. Bleeding, you can get thrombi, right, in this, which is interesting. So we give oral glucocorticoids. No cortisone therapy for you, huh? Just the IG. Okay. For heparin-induced, we obviously live with the heparin. Anybody who's on Coumadin, heparin, warfarin, we're very, very careful that they don't develop thrombocytopenia. We really watch their clotting factors and make sure that they're okay. Platelet transfusions might be required, plasma exchange, a splenectomy. Sometimes we take out the spleen because the spleen is destroying too many cells. Missing diagnosis, ineffective protection, impaired Peyronie's membranes. Like you so lovely put it out about your tongue swelling and your problems with your mucosa. Your lovely case study, that was perfect. What about hemophilia? Anybody have any experience there? Yeah.
Well, I used to be anyway.
Yeah, tell us about your friend.
I just know that what was cool about it, well, not cool, but it was different about his was that I know it's hereditary, but his was completely like a genetic, what's it called, when it's like a mal. I don't know what it's called. It's like a genetic, what is it called?
It's a genetic disease.
Yeah, but it's like, it was like a spontaneous thing. It wasn't genetic, like there was something in his family that just happened.
Oh.
What is that called? A gene, like.
Oh, a mutation?
Mutation. It was a
mutation.
Really?
Oh, and that was
different about his.
Yeah, it was different about it. This was caused by a genetic mutation.
Mm-hmm. So they did a lot of research, like they
I'm
really
sure
wanted
they
to
did.
Know. And because there's like other, because he was the firstborn, so they wanted to know if anybody else.
Absolutely, because if it's genetic, they want to know.
But yeah, for him, it was completely genetic, and nobody else.
Okay, don't remember this. This is weird. Normally, it's not a mutation. It's somewhere I have here. It's an autosomal disease. But anyway, but let's talk about his symptoms, because the symptoms would be consistent.
I we're really young, so I really don't remember. But I just know he wasn't allowed to do anything. Like, he was only allowed in. He's only supposed to stay inside. Like the only. Now he only plays golf, but that's the only sport he's allowed to play. Because there's a different tiers of what like sports you're allowed to play, and golf is like tier, I don't know which.
Tier 50 or something. That
yeah.
It's kind of
it's like
injury.
A lot of contact.
So what happens with hemophilia? Anybody know? Their blood clot. Mm-hmm. They're deficient in one of the clotting factors. I used to give a handout in this class about clotting cascade, but then people got confused and thought they had to memorize all of it, so I stopped giving out to you. But the clotting cascade, you would go from this factor to this factor to this factor to this factor, you would end up being able to clot. If any of those clotting factors are missing, your blood can't clot. Everything has to be there for the blood to go through the series to turn out clot, to be able to have the ability to clot. Hemophiliacs are missing one of those factors, and there are other blood disorders that have a reduction or a absence of clotting factors that prohibit the clotting of blood. So this young man, if his blood wouldn't clot, he can't go play baseball, can he? No. What's going to happen if he gets a scrape in his leg? It could be life-threatening. Right? Yeah. Generally, unlike this young man, but this is the first case I've heard that is from a mutation, almost always, it's an X-linked recessive disorder. Okay, X-linked recessive, what does that mean? X-linked means that it's on the X chromosomes, right? Okay. So it's passed from mothers to sons. Why would it be unlikely that a daughter would get it? Yes, say that again, perfect.
They have another X,
right? And since it's recessive, the dominant chromosome is going to take over and it's not going to show. Whereas the sons, they only have one X, right? So if they get the hemophilia, the X chromosome with the hemophilia gene on it, they're going to get that leg with the hemophilia, and that's all they've got, so they're going to exhibit it. So if a woman is recessively carrying a gene for hemophilia, half her sons are going to have hemophilia, right? Because they have 50-50 chance which X are they going to get from her. Where the daughters, most of the time, are going to have the other X. It's going to take two hemophilic Xs to create a hemophilic woman. Very rare. But only one X to create a man, because it's also more recessive. The women are always going to have the dominant gene to overpower the recessive. So that's why we see the men much more often than the women. Mild or moderate, there can be severe. Again, gradations. You can produce a little of this, and most of these bleeding disorders are like that. You can produce a little of the factor, so sometimes when people are fine. They'll go through a test and they'll be fine. Other times they go into surgery and they bleed out and die. They go, huh? What? I didn't know I had a problem. No. Which is why we almost always do clotting tests before we go into surgery. One of the other reasons. Make sure people can clot. DIC is interesting. Disseminated intravascular coagulation is characterized by intravascular clotting and bleeding. So you go back and forth. It can be severe, life-threatening. Sepsis is a common etiology. And it's endometrial damage, and then it's an inhibition of the clotting cascade. Clotting factors are acuted in that one. So that's kind of interesting. Let's see. We're going to give plasma, obviously, and heparin may be given to interfere with that clotting because it's going to fast clot. Okay, sound good? Let's see. I want to make sure I don't mess up the garage band as I did this morning. Please stay with me. Stop it. I'm going to share it right away so we get to iTunes. Okay. I tend to just like leave my computer. Anyway, while I'm working on that, I won't go anywhere. For you, I have a little test. We talked about your child's triangle last week, right? What is it?